a trusted voice of truth and light.
The narratives that mislead most of us aren't outright lies. They're the deliberate omission of facts that could give us a more complete picture.
And a rally point for those who've accepted the reality that they are not sheep.
The world needs your leadership. And the essence of leadership is using your influence wisely, wherever you happen to be standing.
This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Hey, thank you so much for being a part of my audience today. My fellow wrong thinker, pull up a chair. Let's discuss matters of great importance as we revel in wrong think. By the way, our show is brought to you by Jeff Staples Real Estate, also the Staples Turner team at Patriot Home Mortgage, and Nikki's Wholesale Food Warehouse. Appreciate every one of them being a sponsor. I hope you'll do business with every one of them if you're in a position to do so. So I don't share this too many places, but I'm going to tell you that sometimes I have a part-time side hustle that I do it requires me to work in retail. And yesterday I filled in for a friend who was out sick, and I experienced something that is apparently becoming pretty common. As I talk to my coworkers, there is just a growing saltiness among the public. I was going to use the word surliness, but I think salty pretty well describes it as well. And I'm a pretty pleasant guy. You probably wouldn't know it behind my mask, but I have good people skills. I have good customer service skills, and it's very, very rare that I ever encounter somebody who's really, truly, you know, being a jerk. And yesterday, as I was filling in for my friend, for the first time in many months, I encountered this just spate of people who were just on one. I mean, like, a guy came up and threw the merchandise at me and muttered something surly, and I'm like, wow, really? Now, I don't return this in kind. You know, you've got to swallow your pride, and, you know, the customer's right. Just let them do their thing. But it was crazy because in the space of about 30 minutes, I think I had at least four more people who were just clearly having a rotten day. See, I don't take it personal. I have that option. And I guess we all do, right? Nobody is duty bound to take offense. That's a personal choice. When someone is trying to push your buttons, I think the wisest thing to do is just don't give them a reaction. That's what they're looking for. So deny them the reaction. And, it remains their problem as opposed to becoming your problem. But it got me wondering, what is in the air? And I actually turned to one of my coworkers after a little bit and I said, what is the vibe I'm putting off? One that says, hey, I'm up for some abuse today. Please pile on. And the response was, you know what? We're seeing it more and more. Every single day, it seems like people are just coming in off the street, just angry, tense. Which kind of makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, look at what's going on around us. Look at the pressure that people are under to mask or not to mask. You know, did you wear your MAGA hat today or not? There's pressure coming from many different angles. The divisiveness is almost palpable in American society. So I guess I can understand where people are getting testy with us, with one another, and taking it out on each other. And I'll just say it kind of sucks to be on the receiving end of that, but hey, we all have bad days from time to time. I'm willing to cut them some slack. I just expect the same in return. But as far as the divisiveness that now permeates American society, I bet you're like me in that you've probably wondered, so when does it end? I mean, once we get past November 3rd, once we get past the election, can things go back to normal? And I don't want to sound like a pessimist, but frankly, I think when we get to November 3rd, it's going to kick into overdrive. I think it's going to get worse. And I wish I was more optimistic. I wish it was like, no, we're going to be dancing arm in arm in the streets. And, you know, it's going to be great. Everybody's going to be hugging each other in spite of social distancing and what have you. No. But when it comes to why we are so divided, and why some are so invested in keeping us divided, there has to be a reason. Jeff Thomas, in an article published on LouRockwell.com, I think has a very reasonable explanation as to why it serves some people's interests to keep us angry, tense, and preferably at one another's throats. So if we start with the question, when will the divisiveness end? Jeff Thomas's answer is, it won't. He says those who watch American news programs may choose to watch MSNBC or CNN and shall witness a liberal expert expressing great frustration that the Republican president and his supporters promote divisiveness. And then this will be followed by a discussion between the host of the show and other liberal pundits, echoing this pronouncement and expressing their horror that a country is being led by a truly evil man who is tearing the country apart. Just as worrisome, they say, is that those who support his party, the mostly male, mostly white, mostly racist Republican voters, fervently support the creation of divisiveness. Now, Jeff Thomas says if this was truly a news station, the discussion would end there and the station would move on to another topic, but that's not what happens. Instead, another expert appears on the screen, frustrated and fearful of what he describes as the divisiveness of the president. And this pattern repeats regularly for the remainder of the 24 hours and thence into the next day's news. Now listen closely, he says, but this, of course, is not news. It is by definition indoctrination. Should the viewer decide that he's being brainwashed, he may want to switch over to Fox News, on which a conservative expert will express great frustration that the Democratic Party and their paid lackeys, the media, are promoting divisiveness. This will be followed by a discussion between the host of the show and other conservative pundits, echoing this pronouncement and expressing their horror that the truly evil Democrats are tearing the country apart. And again, this is not news. It is, by definition, indoctrination. And if Americans, most of whom view only one side of this rhetoric, not the other, are asked what they think of this charade, Jeff Thomas says virtually all will state that they are deeply committed to their anger at the evil enemy that has unilaterally created the problems of America today. Each side equally blames the other for being the sole cause of the divisiveness. Each wants it to end, but believes that it cannot end until the evil demon is brought to its knees. And of course, each regards the other as the evil demon. And so Jeff Thomas asks, so what's going on here? Logic tells us they cannot both be correct. And so, for those people who can muster the objectivity to step well away from the fray, what can be seen is a manufactured evil. Indeed, every comment by those on one side, no matter how benign, is immediately described by the opposing side as proof of guilt. He says what we're seeing is conventional political party posturing blown way out of proportion by a media that's on steroids in its condemnation, and that's on both sides. So if we do step back and begin to comprehend that divisiveness is manufactured, then he says we must also conclude that it is intentional, that the object is not to resolve differences, it's to whip the proletariat up into a frenzy and keep them in that state. Now, historically, whenever a government has sought to create for itself totalitarian domination over its minions, it first recognizes that massive force is going to be required. And the proletariat must be prepped for this in advance if they are to accept it. Jeff Thomas says, increasingly, this is what we are witnessing in the U.S. Conservative supporters are biting their nails to the quick in fear of a liberal party that seems to have gone mad. They fear liberals who express themselves by setting cities on fire, looting and murdering people in the streets, making outrageous demands for elimination of police, and creating unpayable debt to fund those who do not contribute to productivity. The prospect of such people taking control of the government will result in a collapse into collectivism, utterly destroying all that conservatives hold dear. And liberal supporters live in terror of a conservative party that supports a racist, sexist ogre of a man who has murdered hundreds of thousands of American people through his mishandling of the coronavirus epidemic and destroyed the economy in doing so. Any of this sound familiar? He says totalitarianism needs a demon. However, it's difficult to create a demon, then to convince all the people to recognize it as such. It's far easier to pit one half of the electorate against the other, feed each side with the same basic information, but with a different slant for each side. In that fashion, when one side defends its position, the other immediately recoils, having been programmed to do so and not realizing that both of the opposing positions have been blown out of proportion. And he has a quote here from George Orwell in the guise of the Ministry of Truth from 1984. Remember this? We are at war with East Asia. We have always been at war with East Asia. Except today, it's not East Asia, it's the man next door who is your enemy. Okay, we got to take a break. We'll come back here in a few moments and we will again pursue this article from Jeff Thomas, published on lewrockwell.com. When will the divisiveness end? It's not going to end because there are people who think it's in their interest to keep it alive. We'll be back in a moment.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Hey, welcome back to the show. I am sharing with you an article from Jeff Thomas. This is entitled, When Does the Divisiveness End? And I think he does a pretty good job of outlining how it's perpetuated. You know, we are set into this this paradigm where, look, it's them or us. Each side sees the other as irredeemably evil. And, of course, with an election ongoing and with, you know, the climax coming less than a month from now with election night, it just is building to a crescendo. But have you ever considered that maybe those who really want to consolidate control are doing this or fomenting this division because it serves their purposes? He says, historically, the most common method to create a demon, which allows totalitarianism to, you know, really gain a toehold, is to characterize another country as the demon. But George Orwell, you know, in his Ministry of Truth, talked about we are at war with East Asia. We've always been at war with East Asia. What if instead of directing our anger against a country, we were seeing a more immediate, more effective method being used, meaning the man next door is the enemy. Possibly even your own family member is your enemy. Partnerships mean nothing. Friendships mean nothing. Family means nothing. Any enemy of the state is your enemy. He's a direct threat to your well-being. I mean, stop and think for just a moment. Isn't that the kind of language that you're hearing? Again, from both sides, as they try to steer people one direction or the other, primarily using fear and anger. Jeff Thomas says this, of course, is at the very heart of totalitarian control, the idea that that guy there is a direct threat to your well-being. He says, no man is intended to work with others to resolve whatever differences may exist. Under these conditions, he's intended to work for the state to destroy the enemy of the state. Okay, let's just put it in really plain language. The lesson here is that totalitarian control thrives on hatred. Anyone who finds that he's been programmed to hate the opposing group or party is already an operative of the state. Let that sink in for a moment. If you spend any portion of your day, I don't care how great or small, just sitting and reflecting on how much I hate those people or that person or them, you've been programmed. You're playing into the hands of those who are trying to assume greater and greater control of everyone. And Jeff Thomas says, once the great majority have taken sides and backed it up with hatred, the next step is bondage, a bondage that will be shared by all. The proletariat will not only tolerate the bondage, they will actually march toward it with confidence that it is their salvation. It would be a mistake to wait for the divisiveness to end. It won't. It's not intended to. Now, I know that's got to sound like some pretty harsh news. Well, then what are we supposed to do? Okay. Again, pull up a chair. Let's talk about that. First and foremost, you and I have to become unplayable pieces on that chessboard. That means thinking for yourself. That means taking ownership for your worldview, refusing to be programmed. Look, I know that even though I love to stay informed, but I know if I spend too much time on Twitter, eventually I'm going to be seeing videos of Antifa doing Antifa stuff. And I start to feel hatred towards them. I see broken, reprehensible human beings, possibly demonically possessed human beings based on their language and their actions, doing horribly hateful things to other human beings in the name of saving us from fascism. But there's a direct relation to how much of that content I consume and how much of that hatred is able to take hold in my own life. Do you see the picture? I have to eliminate it, or I have to step back from it. Otherwise, I get programmed too. I think every one of us should be part of the fight, but I'm not talking about, you know, knuckles in the streets. I think every one of us should be part of the fight to preserve the human rights, the natural rights that accrue to every single human being by virtue of the fact that they are alive and that they are created, not by government, but by a loving creator. And what this article says to me is with this divisiveness that's going on, especially the fact that I believe he's made a good case here, that it's an engineered kind of divisiveness. We still need to stand for what's true and we still need to stand for what's right, but we've got to do it without bringing more anger or more divisiveness into the situation. Now here's the tough part. Because all you have to do is simply hold to truth. No matter how gentle, no matter how benevolent you do it, I promise you someone is waiting to be deeply offended and to really go on the warpath because you are not marching in lockstep with them. And it's not just the left. You'll see this on the right as well. Which brings me to another topic here. Look around you. Look at the friendships in your life. Look at your family relationships. And tell me this, do you have friendships or family relationships that are either strained or possibly falling apart over politics? Because this is part of that divisiveness we were talking about earlier. And I'm going to suggest that it's a choice that we make. Well, I just can't talk to that person anymore, and this person is so wrong. I see this in so many different ways. I recently reconnected with an old friend. And, you know, I'm not trying to be judgmental when I say this, but wow, she likes to fight. I mean, she's a full-blown internet warrior. Takes one to know one. I've been there myself. But fight to the death. And it turns into ugliness and name-calling and, you know, questioning of one another's motives. And I'm better than you. I'm smarter than you. I have more credentials than you kind of stuff. Throwing GPAs around like gang signs. Yo, man, you know, who are you to question me? That's not what we're like normally. There's a great article by Melanie Green. I just saw this on intellectualtakeout.org. Why friendships are falling apart over politics. And she starts by reminding us former Supreme Court Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Antonin Scalia were on the opposite sides of the political spectrum. Yet, despite their obvious legal disagreements, the liberal Ginsburg once described herself and conservative Scalia as best buddies. And Melanie Green says this connection seems surprising today because it's a connection across ideological lines. A striking feature of the current political moment is the extent to which it has affected personal relationships, with friendships fissuring over political issues. Now, a recent Pew study showed just how deep that divide has become. This survey found that roughly 40% of registered voters said they do not have a single close friend backing a different presidential candidate. Really? The old mantra to never discuss religion or politics was a recognition that political differences can create awkward social situations. But Melanie Green says research that her and her colleagues conducted, that the mere prospect, they find that the mere prospect of discussing divisive topics can make you feel anxious and threatened. Yet something about our current moment seems to have put a particular strain on our personal relationships. She's identified a couple of things that really contribute to this divide. So we'll cover those in a few moments. We'll be back just the other side of this break.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
Hey, once again, thanks for joining us. I want to mention the Staples Turner team at Patriot Home Mortgage. Very grateful to have them as sponsors of the Brian Hyde Show. And if you are in the market for a new home loan, or maybe you want to refinance your existing home loan, you need to talk to my friend John Staples and his wife Heather. They are superstars, and Patriot Home Mortgage is active in 23 different states. So there's a very good chance, if you're within the sound of my voice, they can help you. Go to staplesmortgage.com. That's staplesmortgage.com. And when you talk to them, be sure to tell them, I came to see you guys because Brian Hyde said you're the best. They'll appreciate it. And I will too. Thanks. All right, sharing an article from Melanie Green. This is on intellectualtakeout.org about how why friendships are falling apart over politics. Now, she says, as a social psychologist and communication researcher, she has noticed two key features of today's political environment that are making friendships across the political divide challenging. And they are the role of social media and the way in which our political affiliations have become linked to morality and identity. Listen to this. So let's talk about anti-social media. She says, while social media may have its benefits, it's more difficult to have an in-depth, respectful discussion of issues while online. This makes sense, right? Written posts can be misinterpreted. The character limits of a tweet or post may prevent users from conveying the full complexity of their views, while the relative impersonality of online communication may make it easy to forget there's a real person behind the screen. Furthermore, media companies have financial incentives to keep people engaged and enraged. Messages that are more emotional are more widely shared. Thus, people are more likely to see posts that fuel outrage toward the other side. Divisive content may also originate with trolls or disinformation campaigns intentionally designed to increase social division. Here's the big question I have for you, and for myself. Would you recognize it? If it was in front of you, would you know when someone was trying to pull your chain? Just a thought. Next, she talks about identity and morality and says it seems as though political issues are becoming more intertwined with individuals' identities and sense of morality. When being a supporter of a particular politician or party is a strong sense of one's sense of identity, it may be easier to view the other side in a negative way. Now, this is basic human nature. Humans have a need to belong and to be a part of groups. And this us versus them mentality can arise even if people don't have strong positions on political issues. Hearing a lot about politics as the election approaches keeps people focused on these identities. Politicians or media outlets can reinforce this sense of conflict. Politicians often attempt to draw comparisons, or contrasts rather, between themselves and their opponents, sometimes by disparaging the supporters on the other side. Whether it's Hillary Clinton's basket of deplorables comment during the 2016 election, or Trump's regular barrage of Twitter insults, which have included retweeting a video in which someone says, "The only good Democrat is a dead Democrat." She says, then there are the other issues that are highlighted, and it's one thing to disagree about tax policy. It's quite another to disagree about whether certain groups deserve fundamental rights or whether the other side supports killing babies or locking kids in cages. when one person believes the policies and politicians supported by another person are inherently evil or immoral, it's difficult to maintain a friendship. But she also says, now, there is a hopeful note here. The Pew survey suggests that 6 in 10 registered voters do have close friends on the other side of the political divide. So all is not lost, but sometimes we need to be reminded so-called red states and blue states are actually, they're all purple states and contain people across the political spectrum, which means many Americans' friendships remain intact despite a stressful election cycle. These reminders of shared affection, she says, and values may help bring the country together, no matter the outcome of November's contentious election. This is one of the reasons why I'm fairly adamant about taking politics out of the equation wherever possible. Because increasingly politics has become just a contest about which way will the swords be pointing when this election is over. Which side will have won the mandate to say, okay, we're in charge, now you have to do what we say. Because right now both sides seem pretty intent on maintaining or grabbing that power, I should say, and then using it to punish those who don't think like they do. Yes, both sides. That's pretty ugly stuff. Let's talk for a moment about the incentives that drive voters to the voting booth. Art Carden, writing for the American Institute for Economic Research, has a great piece on voters' incentives and terrible public policy. By the way, there are links to all of the stories that I'm referencing in today's show notes at thebrianhydeshow.com. Art Carden says public policy represents a puzzle. Why is so much of it so bad? It seems like every day in a principles of economic class becomes, let's see the disastrous unintended consequences of ostensibly well-intentioned government interventions. Now he says, to be fair, economists disagree about a lot, but there are a lot of issues on which there is a professional consensus that transcends ideologies and schools of thought. Back in 2012, NPR put together a no-brainer economic platform with input from economists across the ideological spectrum. In 2008, Nobel laureate Paul Krugman, who is no free market fundamentalist, wrote of ethanol that it's bad for the economy, bad for consumers, bad for the planet. What's not to love? Now, as Krugman has written elsewhere, if there were an economist's creed, it would certainly contain the affirmations, I understand the principle of comparative advantage, and I advocate free trade. Now, a 2017 episode of NPR's Planet Money interviewed Krugman's fellow Nobel laureate, Joseph Stiglitz, also not a free market fundamentalist, on the little-known Jones Act, which, according to the Cato Institute, requires that water transportation of cargo between U.S. ports be limited to ships that are U.S.-owned, U.S.-crewed, U.S.-registered, and U.S.-built. According to a 2008 paper by Dennis Coates and Brad R. Humphreys, economists do reach a conclusion on subsidies for sports franchises, stadiums, and mega events. They're economically wasteful. Even a lot of economists who support higher minimum wages think they will cause at least modest job losses, but believe this to be an acceptable price to pay for an important social signal. And so Art Carden asks, what gives? Why do we have so much public policy that flies in the face of consensus views among professional economists? Well, it might very well be that we economists are wrong, he says, but I doubt it. The laws of comparative advantage, demand and supply, are anvils that have worn out many hammers. Nuh-uh, doesn't seem like a very convincing refutation of the claim that free international trade actually makes people in both trading countries better off. Economists and political scientists who study the issue have come up with few explanations. One explanation is pretty straightforward, though. And he says, a lot of public policies have concentrated benefits and dispersed costs. Sugar tariffs and quotas, to use just one example, take millions of dollars out of the pockets of American sugar consumers and put them in the pockets of American sugar producers, with inefficiencies coming first from the fact that we're wasting resources producing sugar domestically when we could have gotten it cheaper by trading for it. And second, from the fact that higher sugar prices mean we get to enjoy less sugar than we otherwise would have. These millions of dollars are spread out among millions of sugar consumers, hardly any of whom spend enough on sugar every year to keep careful track of it, and tell you how much the tariffs and quotas are costing them. They're lavished upon a small number of sugar producers who have a powerful incentive to lobby Congress in order to keep the tariffs and quotas in place, and therefore to keep those millions coming. So with a bit of imagination or 5 minutes spent perusing the Federal Register, you can no doubt come up with dozens of other examples. When benefits are concentrated and costs are dispersed, it's a lot easier to organize support for an inefficient policy, and it's a lot harder to organize opposition. In addition, vote trading or so-called log rolling in a majority rule system makes it fairly easy for groups that are part of a majority coalition to secure benefits at the expense of the minority. James M. Buchanan and Gordon Tullock explore this in The Calculus of Consent, and in fact he links to a chapter that explains how log rolling can lead to better outcomes, but it also means that there is no end to the ways in which majorities can exploit minorities by exchanging support for one another's preferred policies. Now he says, more importantly, people do not need to be devious, evil, or self-absorbed. They might simply disagree about what constitutes the common good. And he goes into some more detail on this, which we will cover coming up here in the next few minutes. Again, this is from Art Carden from the American Institute for Economic Research, and a very great explanation on voters' incentives and terrible public policy. We'll be back right after this.
This is the Brian Hyde Show. This is the Brian Hyde Show.
And just like that, we are back. I just want to summarize the article here from Art Carden from the American Institute for Economic Research on voters' incentives and terrible public policy. And this is how he summarizes his points. He says, in about a month, Americans will elect a new president and a new Congress. Now, in our ideal world, they would do so by very carefully weighing the costs and benefits of different policies and choosing the combinations they reasonably believe to be everyone's best interests. But in the world we inhabit, though, he says, they will go to the polls and vote enthusiastically for policies that create more common harm than common good. In some cases, it will be straightforward pocket-picking where they vote for someone who promises to give them stuff at someone else's expense. In other cases, they might vote for policies that don't affect them directly, but that impoverish us all on net. And his point is, in order to understand why people do it like this, we have to consider their incentives. Great article. Again, I recommend go to the website, go to the show notes at thebrianhydeshow.com and check it out for yourself. Okay, two more quick things here. Wanted to talk about the inversion of our values. And there's a great article by Grayson Quay, which I think outlines this. It's called Campus Wokeness and the Evolution of Profanity. And I don't know if you remember this story from last month, but the University of Southern California removed a business professor from his classroom after he said a Chinese word that is pronounced similarly to the N-word. Warning his students against using filler words during presentations, Professor Greg Patton gave examples such as like, and in an effort to be inclusive of his Chinese students, ni ga. Needless to say, this word, which translates to that, has no etymological relation to the English racial slur. But a group of USC students wrote a letter to the administration claiming that by simply hearing a word, and they mean subjectively hearing a word that they say is a clear synonym, they meant homophone, but that's far from the dumbest thing in this letter, of a slur, they had been burdened to fight with our existence in society. I think they meant fight for, but he says, I guess when you're triggered, the last thing on your mind is proofreading. In reply, the business school dean, Jeffrey Garrett, wrote, it is simply unacceptable for the faculty to use words in class that can marginalize, hurt, and harm the psychological safety of our students. I seem to remember a professor a few years ago using the word niggardly, meaning stingy, and students were likewise triggered. Not smart enough to figure out what the word means. No, you couldn't be bothered to see if there is in fact a definition. They just heard what they wanted to hear. Hey, that sounded like the N-word, and they went off. And I believe that professor was removed from his position. Now, Grayson Quay says the whole thing reminded him of an Atlantic article from last year. After Beto O'Rourke dropped an F-bomb on the campaign trail, linguist John McWhorter jumped to the would-be president's defense. Profanity, McWhorter explained in his article, has evolved over time. He outlines three periods, which I'll label the religious, the decorous, and the inclusive. The typical curses of the religious period include theological terms like damn and hell. The decorous period focused on modesty, so words relating to sex, excrement, and body parts involved therein became taboo. McWhorter's argument is that Beto's F-bomb was not as shocking as it would have been a few decades ago, because we've mostly completed the transition from the decorous period to the inclusive period. Crass words about bodily functions are tolerable. Derogatory names for minorities are not, even if that's not what the person actually said. Now, this division is useful in that it reveals what each era believed to be sacred. From the earliest days of civilization through the Middle Ages, it was God or the gods. Speaking loosely of divine things risked calling down divine wrath. Profanity was literally profane, in the sense of being sacrilegious. By the Renaissance, however, the ancient dread was fading. Shakespeare's plays are loaded with expletives like zounds, which is short for God's wounds. I didn't know that. In the Victorian era, propriety was king. The survival of society depended on the individual and the state being regulated according to rational, hierarchical principles. This extended to one's body, which was expected to be controlled at all times. Such a way of thinking leaves little room for the body's less presentable parts and functions. Even the word leg came to be considered too sexy. He says it's no accident that the curse words of this era were almost all synonyms for bodily parts and functions. To talk about what happened in the bedroom or the bathroom was to undermine civilization itself. In the present inclusive period, sacredness has passed from religion and propriety to diversity and human dignity. Now, Grayson Quay says, in some ways, this is a step in the right direction. Surely a word that dehumanizes an entire group of people ought to be more offensive than a synonym for but. But he says, this belief in universal human worth draws from the doctrines of Imago Dei, and the Incarnation. Although, by severing them from their religious roots, the movement is quickly distorted and rendered absurd. Today we seem to have fallen back into the superstitious dread and magical thinking that defined the early days of the religious period of profanity. The Code of Hammurabi, written around 1750 BC in ancient Mesopotamia, declares that if a man has accused another of laying a nirtu upon him, but has not proved it, he shall be put to death. Now we aren't exactly sure what a nirtu is, but in context, it appears to be some sort of spell. It's a series of words so fearsome that the penalty for falsely accusing someone of pronouncing them is death. Anyone accused of uttering a kispu, presumably a less serious curse, was to be subjected to a trial by water. Dr. Patton is currently experiencing a similar ordeal for using the Chinese word nege. The actions of USC's administration, says Grayson Quay, betray the same superstitious fear of mere words. A teacher who maliciously utters slurs in the classroom ought to be punished. But what happened to Patton is different. Not only did he say the word without any hate in his heart, he didn't say the word at all. We've all heard of a victimless crime, but this is a crime that has no perpetrator. In their complaint against him, Patton's students implied that intent and knowledge do not matter, only a specific arrangement of sounds. And whenever they hear these sounds, they argue violence is committed against them, and anyone who questions their right to seek restitution for the supposed offense is guilty of further violence. Wow, that sounds like a game they can't lose. And Grayson Quay says, in light of the now fashionable theory of generational trauma, that harm extends to their offspring as well. Now, in their extremism, they outdo even Hammurabi. The ancient lawgiver's penalties may have been harsher, but he was wise enough to include protections against spurious accusations of cursing and penalties for making such false accusations. That's a good point. The decorous era of profanity from which we are emerging may have been prudish, but it was never so irrationally hostile toward those who violated its taboos. The modern zealots of social justice have much more in common with the worshippers of Baal than they may care to admit. I don't know why, but that kind of makes me chuckle. Just because, yeah, it's it's okay to drop F-bombs. But heaven forfend that you say a word that someone might misinterpret or not understand, and that may sound somewhat similar to another word which they absolutely cannot tolerate. Fascinating stuff. One final thought here. This is from Paul Craig Roberts. COVID's threat is greater than its medical one. Now, he says, as his readers know, he doesn't think the COVID virus itself is a hoax. From the beginning, he's taken the virus seriously. He reported the available information that the ability of the virus to spread threatened hospital capacity and could overwhelm the medical system. And he supported limited close downs in order to reduce the rate at which the infection spread. He says, I reported vitamin C and D3 together with zinc and NAC strengthened the immune system against the virus. And he talks about how, you know, hydroxychloroquine, you know, has come into the picture. And as more information comes available, we see that a second wave, the argument for another lockdown based on a second wave is based on increased testing using a test that produces false positives. But he says, here's the big threat. It's not COVID. It's the gullibility of the American public. Because the American public has been indoctrinated. And he says, COVID is a danger, but so is life. Why wreck the economy and civil liberty over this one danger, especially as the danger has been exaggerated? Paul Craig Roberts says Americans need to recover from their gullibility. Too many Americans believe the prostitutes, too many people believe public authorities, but too few Americans understand that every crisis, real or manufactured, is an opportunity for an interest group's profit and power. Yeah, the explanations that we get are controlled for the sake of serving profit and power. And if the public doesn't catch on, he says we're going to pay a price for that. Check it out. You'll find the article in the show notes. And again, thanks for joining us.
This is the Brian Hyde Show.